speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, January 28, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
The People's Historian Howard Zinn passes away at the age of 87. We'll pay him tribute. And President Obama's first State of the Union. We'll hear excerpts and analysis. And we'll take listener calls on Zinn and Obama.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The legendary historian, activist, and writer Howard Zinn passed away yesterday at the age of 87. He died of a heart attack while traveling through Southern California. The author of the best-selling A People's History of the United States, which sold over a million copies, influenced countless numbers of people, including myself. Howard Zinn was a bombardier in World War II. It was an experience that forever changed his opinion of war. He wrote books, taught at universities, marched and protested in the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and today's anti-war movements. He was a mentor, a role model, and a personal hero to many of us. Reading A People's History of the United States changed my life. I had no idea, even after having taken history courses in college, that the United States had such a rich history of dissent, of people fighting power, until I read Zinn's book. When I first moved to Southern California, I went to see Zinn speak at a local college. It was my first time seeing him in person, and I didn't know then that someday I would have the privilege of meeting him one-on-one and interviewing him on public radio. Howard was the kind of guy you could just call on the phone, and he would answer. Hold on, he'd say, let me just check my schedule. Sure, I can do an interview. Today, all of us who were touched by Howard Zinn grieve his loss. The last time I had the honor of interviewing Howard was on Uprising a couple of months before the 2008 presidential election. This is what Howard Zinn had to say. So we are heading into what many people have called a historic race. Do you, as people's historian, consider this historic, and if so, why?
I guess every race is historic, I don't know if I would call it historic. It's another election between two candidates, and what's I suppose important about this race is that we have been at war for 5 years. After all, the presidential elections leading up to the Vietnam War historic, the president's elections during the Vietnam War historic, the presidential election in 1916 when the United States was about to enter World War I was historic. So yes, any election when war and peace are the issues is a historic election. And I suppose, well, there is something specially historic about this election as we have a black man running for president. To me, whether it's historic or not is really the important thing. I mean, these protests that are taking place are taking place at the Democratic Convention, I think, because there are a lot of people in the country who think that Barack Obama and the Democratic Party have failed to make a bold case to the American people in this coming election. And your news report was that the race is very, very close. And I think that one reason the race is very, very close is that there has not been a very clear, bold statement by the Democratic Party leaders, including Obama, about withdrawal of troops from Iraq. In this morning's newspaper, there's a report of how the Bush administration is talking about a timetable for withdrawal. Well, if the Republicans talk about a timetable for withdrawal, and Barack Obama talks about a timetable for withdrawal, even though the timetables are different, They talk about a couple of years. Barack Obama talks about 16 months. Both of them hedged around with conditions. Then it becomes hard for people who want the war to end right away, and I think this is true of a majority of the American people, hard for them, for the American people, to make a clear distinction between the candidates. So I think the idea of the protest is to say to the Democratic Party and to say to Barack Obama, you really want to create a great gap between you and the Bush administration. You want to make very clear that you are for the immediate withdrawal of American armed forces from Iraq, and that, in fact, you want to do more. You want the United States to really change its policy from being an aggressive military force in the world to being a peace-loving nation. I think that kind of clear statement by the Democratic Party and by the presidential candidate would give the voters a choice. That would be historic.
Howard,
have a choice.
Howard, you signed on, along with several others, to an open letter to Barack Obama just published in The Nation called Change We Can Believe In. And in it, you ask Barack Obama to, quote, stand firm on the principles you have so compellingly articulated. Now, the right and the Republican Party is already accusing Barack Obama of being a radical leftist. Mm. Do you think that he would risk actually taking the stands that you ask him to take and that he has in the past promised to take? And if so, if he did do so, could he win the election?
I think that's the only way he could win. I don't think it would be risky for him to take a more clear-cut and bold stance on the war, on health care, on taxing the rich, on changing the policy of the country, using the wealth of the country instead of for military purposes, for health and education. No, that would not be a risk. I think the greater risk for the Democratic Party and Obama is taking half-hearted positions on the war, taking complicated positions on health plan, talking about trivial things. You know, I heard your news broadcast, and they talk about how Obama is accusing McCain of not saying how many houses he owned. This is trivial. This is not important. So I think the idea that Obama will lose votes and lose the election if he takes a bold stand is absolutely wrong. I think there's a fundamental problem here, and that is that the Obama and the Democratic Party, I think, are yielding to Republican definitions of what is strength and what is national security. And I understand that the convention of the Democratic Party sort of is emphasizing as its theme national security. And what national security is defined as by both the Republican and also the Democratic Party is military strength. And I think what the Democratic Party has to do is redefine national security, not as military power, but redefine it as health security, employment security, child security, environmental security. That would be true national security. And if the Democratic Party thinks it must show that it is militarily strong by, let's say, removing troops from Iraq and putting troops in Afghanistan, then I think it is risking losing the election, because I think all the polls of the last several years show that the American people now want, in a very strong and clear way, want us to get out of the war in the Middle East.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. Oh, you see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know,
John Legend singing a cover of the Marvin Gaye song. We heard from the late Howard Zinn, who died yesterday at the age of 87. The interview excerpt that you heard was done on August 22, 2008, just a few months before the presidential election. It was the last time we spoke to Howard on Uprising. And as you heard, he was able to touch on many issues that are still relevant today. We want to hear from you how Howard Zinn touched you later in the hour when we'll be taking your listener calls. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break for today's Subversive Historian. When we come back, analysis of the president's first State of the Union address.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Mother, mother. Everybody thinks we're wrong.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on January 28, 1854, the Nasoma Village Massacre took place in southern Oregon. Tensions between native peoples and whites had been mounting in the area as incursions and settlements inflamed temperaments. 2 years prior to the bloodshed, gold had been discovered at the mouth of the Coquille River, leading to a rush of miners along its banks where many natives made their home. After isolated skirmishes, whites issued an ultimatum to the chief of the Coquille people, who then returned one in kind. Shortly thereafter, a vigilante group of 40 miners known as the Randolph Minutemen surrounded the village of Nasoma. In the siege, homes were burned down to the ground as 16 natives were killed. The superintendent of Indian Affairs described the scene as, quote, a massacre too inhuman to be readily believed. In the wake of the killings, the native peoples were removed from their villages along the Coquille River to the Tsilhqot'e Reservation. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying today's subversive day in history is dedicated to the late Howard Zinn, a man who will be remembered as someone that taught us to never forget.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In his more than hour-long State of the Union address yesterday, President Barack Obama outlined his agenda for the future by contextualizing his first year in office. Cognizant of declining approval ratings, the president referenced the deep recession he inherited while articulating an array of issues comprising his domestic agenda. Cognizant of, Obama stated, I campaigned on the promise of change, change we can believe in, the slogan went. And right now, I know there are many Americans who aren't sure if they still believe we can change, or at least that I can deliver. A major point the president went on to address in his speech was the legislative struggle over health insurance reform. Obama acknowledged his own mistakes in presenting the issue to the public, but reiterated the goals sought for reform, such as the end of denying care on the basis of a pre-existing condition. On the economy, the president claimed to have hated the bank bailout as much as anyone else, comparing it to a root canal, while claiming that it had been necessary to stave off a depression. He then followed that with a call to create jobs and invest in clean energy as a means to achieve employment gains. In addressing the deficit, the president drew lukewarm applause and stunted reactions from members of his own party when he spoke of a spending freeze that would leave only a few aspects of government spending, like the military budget, untouched, while placing almost everything else on the potential chopping block. President Obama then rounded out his first State of the Union address by highlighting numerous other issues, such as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as education, immigration, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military, and the recent Supreme Court decision on corporations and election financing. Joining us for the rest of the hour to analyze the president's State of the Union is Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which is a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare, and Dominic Apollon, who is the research director at the Applied Research Center and a frequent commentator on race and politics in the news. Welcome to Uprising, Kathy and Dominic.
Hello, Sonali. Thank you, and hello to Dominic.
Hi, Dominic.
Happy to,
Happy to be here.
So first, let me ask the two of you what your general impressions were of the President's State of the Union. You know, certainly on the face of it, we have to admit, after seeing President Bush for 8 years, it's refreshing to see a president like Obama, who is articulate. But then, of course, it's also important to parse what he is really saying. Kathy Kelly, your sort of broad response on the president's address.
I think that the president held forth desires that many people would share to assure that people would get decent health care, improved education, relieved of the fear that they might lose their home. But I think the practical matter of where the funding and the resources would come from was avoided, and I think it was avoided in as much as he next to never mentioned the spending that goes toward the military, toward the defense establishment, which is like, as in the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, a demonic suction tube. I think that's the gorilla that was kind of sitting in the room that was never acknowledged, never looked at, and it's that refusal to undertake the hard work of educating the U.S. public regarding the multiple wars he, you might say, inherited, and ways to get out of Afghanistan. There wasn't a step in that direction at all. I think there was a great effort to try to placate the base, but it, to me, was a major disappointment.
Dominic, what about your opinion? What do you think of the president's speech overall?
Well, the president's speech was really about the middle class, the middle class, the middle class. I'd say the middle class and independent voters, really. And we didn't hear very much at all about the poor. I mean, we heard about jobs, but really he seems to be wanting to alleviate the fears of the middle class that are now in much more precarious state. A precarious state that, you know, many in, you know, the black community or the black middle class, you know, have been in precarious states for decades, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. There are many, many more Americans now who are in that state. And the president really was speaking more to them. Thought he was, again, a bit naive on some of his continued calls for bipartisanship. I would have liked him to speak more about really just the immorality of the status quo in terms of, again, the poor, poverty. We really didn't hear him talk much about that. And I don't know. I don't think that there are many Republicans who lost sleep last night listening to his renewed calls for bipartisanship.
Let's take a listen to an excerpt of the President's State of the Union, which aired yesterday, which he did yesterday. This aspect, this part of his speech focused on the jobs bill. And then we can talk a little bit more, Dominic and Kathy, about whether what he said, at least on the surface of it, could be promising. Here's President Obama.
I'm proposing that we take $30 billion of the money Wall Street banks have repaid and use it to help community banks give small businesses the credit they need to stay afloat. I'm also proposing a new small business tax credit, one that will go to over 1 million small businesses who hire new workers or raise wages. While we're at it, let's also eliminate all capital gains taxes on small business investment and provide a tax incentive for all large businesses and all small businesses to invest in new plants and equipment.
And that is President Obama in his State of the Union address yesterday. He also went on to talk about putting Americans to work to build the infrastructure of tomorrow and also to build clean energy facilities, giving rebates to Americans to make their homes more energy efficient, and to slash tax breaks for companies that ship our jobs overseas and give those instead to those creating jobs here in the United States. Kathy Kelly and Dominic Apollon are my guests. Kathy, wouldn't you say that at least on the surface of it, this sounds like something better than what we've been seeing in this past year, taking some of those tax credits to wealthy companies away, investing $30 billion in the giving them to community banks so that small businesses can get a head start?
Well, I think certainly being able to identify the financial executives who have profited continually throughout the bailout process and saying that this isn't going to continue is a wise move. And I think that the president has a tremendous capacity to educate average ordinary Americans. But I still wish that he would take it a step further. It seems to me that the opportunity that he has in the State of the Union to galvanize people's energies and to say, look, we all face a common problem, but unless we individually and collectively change our own approaches to consumption of fossil fuels and other limited sources of energy, we won't be able to hand off that much better planet, much better country to next generations. And it seems that there's a lot of effort to say, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do that to stop particular problems, but we need the general education that would awaken people to the catastrophes that we face that have everything to do with our own terrorizing habits in the ways that we consume and waste resources. So I would present a greater challenge to President Obama, but I think he's sometimes himself afraid to step up to that challenge because he wants so badly to be a second-term president, not a one-term president.
Dominic, what is your opinion of the ideas that the president outlined to create jobs and also to infuse, you know, small businesses with credit rather than some of the biggest businesses?
You know, I think there is some potentially good stuff in there as far as tax credits are concerned. As far as spending more money on infrastructure to actually create jobs. I mean, we've seen some of the stimulus money that's been spent now, it's been allocated, is for job training. And we don't just need job training in our communities. We need actual creation of jobs. So, we've seen that in the past, job training programs for jobs that don't exist. And so, there's a lot of promise potentially in the green jobs sector, but we need dollars behind them to actually create jobs. The other thing, I mean, I agree with Kathy in terms of President Obama essentially missing an opportunity to really show leadership and provide some general education, about the recovery generally. So in terms of jobs, again, we want to know, what type of recovery should we have, we need new definitions for economic health in this country. The current definitions of essentially just GDP growth, after several quarters of GDP decline, as if that's an end to our collective woes. It's not. We have to ask ourselves, what sort of recovery will we have? Do we want? And I would argue that we want a more inclusive economy, one that doesn't have the sorts of inequities by race, by gender, that we had before the recession hit, and that really ended up allowing or helping to cause the recession.
Now, one of the major issues that the president talked about in his address was education. And, of course, under President Bush, we saw the No Child Left Behind Act that came with its own set of problems. Under President Obama this past year, he has launched this so-called Race to the Top initiative, and he talked a little bit about what he is planning. Here is President Obama again.
This year, we've broken through the stalemate between left and right by launching a national competition to improve our schools. And the idea here is simple. Instead of rewarding failure, we only reward success. Instead of funding the status quo, we only invest in reform. Reform that raises student achievement, inspires students to excel in math and science, and turns around failing schools that steal the future of too many young Americans, from rural communities to the inner city. In the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education. And in this country, the success of our children cannot depend more on where they live than on their potential. When we renew the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, we will work with Congress to expand these reforms to all 50 states. Still, in this economy, a high school diploma no longer guarantees a good job. That's why I urge the Senate to follow the House and pass a bill that will revitalize our community colleges, which are a career pathway to the children of so many working families. To make college more affordable, this bill will finally end the unwarranted taxpayer subsidies that go to banks for student loans. Instead, let's take that money and give families a $10,000 tax credit for 4 years of college and increase Pell Grants. And let's tell another 1 million students that when they graduate, they will be required to pay only 10% of their income on student loans. And all of their debt will be forgiven after 20 years, and forgiven after 10 years if they choose a career in public service. Because in the United States of America, no one should go broke because they chose to go to college.
The President of the United States, Barack Obama, speaking on Wednesday, his first State of the Union address. So my guests, Kathy Kelly and Dominic Apollon, let me ask you, Kathy, starting with you. Obama said the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education. In this one instance, he did address poverty. What do you make of his ideas?
Well, again, I don't want to be sour grapes, but I can't help but be aware, myself having been a prisoner in the United States for a year in maximum security prison, 3 months in a minimum security prison, there are millions of people in the criminal justice system, and money is being devoted every year, far more than what the president is suggesting per student could be allocated through Pell Grants and through forgiving loans. There's a greater sum being dedicated to locking impoverished, primarily impoverished people up every year in our prison system. And I'm wondering, where is this money going to come from? I'm also conscious that it's going to cost $1 million per soldier, per year to keep a United States soldier in Afghanistan. Now, that's the kind of money I'd like to see redirected toward the wonderful education goals and the greater fairness of an extended education for every person in this country. We have to ask ourselves, where are these funds going to come from? And if we're going to cut and freeze discretionary spending in every department other than the Homeland Security and the Defense Department, then it seems to me the jobs program that the Democrats would be offering is essentially the military and security. And to me, we have to educate our young people to have a far greater vision of their role in the world than that of participating in a very dangerously growing policing force.
And we'll be playing the next excerpt of the speech. We'll focus on what the president said about the spending freeze. Dominic, what do you make of at least the specifics, at least the ideas that the president has put forward? Whether or not he, through Congress, can achieve that is another matter, but the ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I do think he'll probably have more success passing an education bill, passing a jobs bill than he has had with health care. I mean, I think Kathy raises some great points, and we could and should be spending much more of the money that we're spending on incarceration and on our military, on education, to be able to pay our teachers better wages. I know I used to teach in the Cal State system, and, you know, again, the salaries there really weren't up to what they should be, the levels that they should be. Also, as the husband of a community college professor, I was hopeful to hear the president talk about revitalizing community colleges, because it really is an important stepping stone for so many people, particularly in our state here in California. So, I guess I'm encouraged to hear him talk a bit more about education, about making college more affordable, and I think his programs, there aren't a lot of details there just yet in that speech. He could provide more specifics around it, and I think that he could also be a bit more aggressive, but ideally, these programs can help gear more and more individuals and our young people into careers in public service. I thought that was one of his better moments of the night, or one of his, one of the best sound bites, that no one should go broke because they chose to go to college.
My guests are Dominic Apollon, Research Director at the Applied Research Center. He's a frequent commentator on race and politics. And Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which is a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. Kathy, I know you've been talking about throughout our interview how the spending on national security is never, ever questioned, and the president certainly kept that tradition alive in what he said regarding the budget spending freeze. Let's take another listen to Barack Obama.
Starting in 2011, we are prepared to freeze government spending for 3 years. Spending related to our national security, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security will not be affected. But all other discretionary government programs will. Like any cash-strapped family, we will work within a budget to invest in what we need and sacrifice what we don't. And if I have to enforce this discipline by veto, I will. We will continue to go through the budget, line by line, page by page, to eliminate programs that we can't afford and don't work. We've already identified $20 billion in savings for next year. To help working families, we'll extend our middle-class tax cuts. But at a time of record deficits, we will not continue tax cuts for oil companies, for investment fund managers, and for those making over $250,000 a year. We just can't afford it.
The first State of the Union address of President Barack Obama. Kathy Kelly, he, I think, attempted to balance the budget of spending freeze that he is proposing, which is an obvious appeasement of Republicans, with the statement that tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans will not be extended. What do you make of that?
Well, it seems to me the corporate welfare is a concept we should keep in mind, that there are very, very wealthy companies that have, in a sense, never had to engage in very much competition because they have a monopoly on the market. And I am, again, thinking of the major defense industries. And so it's the people in executive positions in those countries who I think have benefited tremendously from continued warfare and from a sort of protected defense establishment budget. And I think we, all of us, have got to raise those questions in our grassroots communities, going to the offices of the elected leadership, our senators and our congresspeople. We can't expect that President Barack Obama single-handedly is going to address these issues. And I know I've kind of invaded several times in this interview time on the importance of looking at the defense expenditures. But I don't mean to say that President Obama bears sole responsibility. It's we in the grassroots who have to stand up and pay attention to those issues. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage everybody to take a 100% tax cut and not pay any money whatsoever
into the defense budget.
Dominic, what do you think of the decision to extend the tax cuts for the middle class, but not for the wealthiest Americans and oil companies, investment fund managers, et cetera?
Yeah, no, that's definitely good.
But then balanced with the spending freeze on all discretionary programs, which could be any number of things.
Yeah, the spending freeze is a little bit scary. And again, I mean, if there's not going to be a freeze or a retrenchment as far as the military is concerned, you know, then what are we doing? What are our priorities there? Does an increased military presence in Afghanistan really serve our national security? Do we need to be spending all of that that money in these foreign wars?
Let's take a listen to what the president said about the issue of war and national security, and then we'll get your responses once more.
Since the day I took office, we've renewed our focus on the terrorists who threaten our nation. We've made substantial investments in our homeland security and disrupted plots that threaten to take American lives. We are filling unacceptable gaps revealed by the failed Christmas attack with better airline security and swifter action on our intelligence. We've prohibited torture and strengthened partnerships from the Pacific to South Asia to the Arabian Peninsula. And in the last year, hundreds of al-Qaeda's fighters and affiliates, including many senior leaders, have been captured or killed, far more than in 2008. And in Afghanistan, we're increasing our troops and training Afghan security forces so they can begin to take the lead in July of 2011 and our troops can begin to come home.
And that's President Barack Obama. He also went on to talk about Iraq and say that the war is ending and that all of our troops are coming home. Dominic Apollon, continue your thoughts on the issue of how national security and the expenses of that on that are never questioned. And neither is it questioned that these expenses and these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq may not actually be making us safer.
Right. I mean that's exactly the point. It sounded to me like he was giving a lot of red meat to Republicans and to independents. He really is talking to independent voters, and the president seems to be a bit worried about his dropping approval ratings. So, he was talking as well about nuclear power plants after that and offshore drilling as well. But, again, the point is that our priorities really shouldn't be in military spending, and we really should be spending more on the creation of jobs, on education as well, and healthcare.
Kathy Kelly, the president went on to say, talk about Iran, saying that as Iran's leaders continue to ignore their obligations, there should be no doubt they too will face growing consequences. That is a promise. Well, it sounds like a threat.
Well, I think also it's something that would never be stated in the State of the Union message, but we have to acknowledge that Israel has been given $30 billion over the stretch of years from 2007 to 2017, and that can only be spent on military. And Israel has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons, which has deeply and grievously destabilized the region, but that wasn't mentioned at all. I think there is a threat to Iran, and it makes me wonder, does the United States want to have bases in Afghanistan in order to better prepare for a future control and possibly preemptive strikes against neighboring states like Iran? It was a big disappointment to me that the president didn't try again to use that opportunity to educate people about potential for negotiation and dialogue with neighboring states of Afghanistan, inclusive of Iran, of Russia, of China, of Pakistan. And also, even Hamid Karzai is talking about negotiations with the Taliban. I think Richard Holbrooke is over there exploring these possibilities. Why not help U.S. people understand that possible dialogue and negotiated solutions would be the precursor to bringing the troops home? Instead, I think we're just encouraged to be frightened, be afraid, be very afraid. And that meanwhile, people don't understand that people all around the world are antagonized deeply because Guantanamo remains open, because purported suicides at Guantanamo, it now seems, have actually been deaths caused by people having been tortured to death, if we don't look in the mirror and see ourselves as we're seen by other people, while we follow these escalating security tactics, we create our own future insecurity. And we heard the president speak about the children, great, great concern for the children, and yet, you know, when he talks about pulling bodies underneath the rubble out of destroyed buildings in Haiti, and then the chant is USA, this, I think, will have a kind of almost toxic effect on other people as they care about their children as much as we care about ours.
I'm speaking with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and Dominic Apollon, research director at the Applied Research Center. In a few minutes, we're going to be taking your calls, and you can call us at 818-985-5735 to react to President Obama's State of the Union address, and also if you want to reflect on the passing of Howard Zinn. 818-985-5735 is that number. Let's take another listen to an excerpt from the President's State of the Union address near the end of his speech, where he talked about the increasing disillusionment that people are having with him.
I campaigned on the promise of change. Change we can believe in, the slogan went. And right now I know there are many Americans who aren't sure if they still believe we can change or that I can deliver it. But remember this. I never suggested that change would be easy, or that I could do it alone. Democracy in a nation of 300 million people can be noisy and messy and complicated. And when you try to do big things and make big changes, it stirs passions and controversy. That's just how it is.
President Barack Obama, Dominic Apollon, is that just how it is?
Well, you know, democracy is messy, and unfortunately, we have a system really that is designed for incremental change only, for obstructionism. So the president is only one individual, and we do need more of that grassroots enthusiasm that we saw to get him elected to be able to pressure him to move in a more progressive direction. You know, I would have liked to have heard him, be, perhaps a bit more combative in the speech last night in terms of talking about bipartisanship and essentially the role that just a handful of senators have played in really obstructing health care reform, for example. The president could have been could have spoken more eloquently about the great, great needs for so many Americans. And if he had done that along the way as well during healthcare, instead of sort of sitting back and letting Congress do its work, then I think he would have found more success.
And Kathy Kelly, I'd like you to reflect on what he said as well. But also, you know, if you look at the way in which he has played his politics in this first year of office, following up on what Dominic was saying, it has been very safe. Instead of saying and acknowledging that there are perhaps irreconcilable differences between the Democrats and Republicans, at least in terms of philosophy. Actions are a different thing. But at least given the differences in philosophy on how to make change on economic issues, on war, et cetera, instead of doing that and then saying, so because we have this majority that we haven't had in a very long time, we're just going to go ahead and do what we need to do because Democrats are in power and that's how democracy works. He has been extremely appeasing of Republicans, bending over backwards, and that's something that Democrats seem to be doing constantly in recent history. But the Republicans don't do it when they're in power. That is,
you know, I think that President Barack Obama really envisions a bipartisan way forward, and some, I'm sure, like me, are hoping that he's kind of a sleeper and at some point he's going to come forward and say, okay, now we've done all that we can to try to bring the Republicans over to a way forward with bipartisanship, but we can't transform the Democratic base into a group of people who are going to be solidly in support of militarism and the security state and creating exceptions for large corporations and maintaining a view of the United States as kind of this exceptional group of people who don't have to play by the laws that dominate the rest of the world. I think that there's a chance yet that President Obama could begin to invoke people like Howard Zinn. I'm positive that he himself has learned a great deal from Howard Zinn and that he has studied the speeches of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King much more so than the invoking of Dr. King's message that happens very occasionally and with words that don't really seem to call people forth to action. So I'm sure that there is more there. But again, I'm here in Washington, D.C. I've been here since January 10th with people who have gone every day to the White House, and there have been repeated actions of nonviolent direct action. I have to say that it's chilling to see how charges have been escalated for simply maintaining a presence in front of the White House commemorating the war dead. People were hit with three severe charges and kept overnight, not allowed to sign a personal recognizance bond. They're making it as unwelcoming as possible for activists to come to Washington, D.C. to petition for redress of grievance. But nevertheless, I think that is our responsibility to keep these kinds of campaigns going that stemmed from successful campaigning in the civil rights movement, in the suffragist movement, in the union development movement.
I want to take our listeners who have been waiting patiently, take their calls now, and let others know that if you want to join in the conversation in the last few minutes of the show, you can call 818-985-5735 with your thoughts on the President's first State of the Union address, as well as on the passing of Howard Zinn. 818-985-KPFK is the number. Waiting patiently on the line from Montclair is Glenda. Welcome to Uprising, Glenda.
Oh, hi, Sonali, and thank you for that tribute to Howard Zinn. We all are going to miss him, but at least KPFK and Pacifica have his voices in the archives. And thanks to Kathy Kelly and to Dominique for their responses. As far as the president's message, the highlight of the speech was when he punched the Supreme Court in the face for their horrible decision last week.
That's right.
And when he took shots at the Republicans. And I frankly would have liked to have seen a little bit more of that. And he also did it in a very smooth way. It wasn't crude, but there needed to be more of it. And as you just talked about the non-existent bipartisanship and own up to that, because it just does not exist. There may be other ways to go about doing some of the programs that he said. Also, the speech was just full of smoke and mirrors. It was going to freeze everything but intelligence, illegal spying, wars, defense wars, and yet they scream about the deficits. Well, if you stop the illegal and immoral wars, we'd have enough to pay for health care and many other social programs. So that's just ridiculous on its face. And then when he said he was going to wait to freeze them next year because the economy would be better, he actually got some jeers and giggles. I mean, this is ridiculous. Most of what he said, his educational program is worse than even Bush's. I won't go into detail there. I mean, you touched on many, many other things. No, this speech was meant to fool the public, recapture the base, but do it with a lot of half-truths, misleading statements, and just political crapola. Sorry.
Glenda, thank you very much for your comments. Let's go next to Frank in North Hollywood. Frank, welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me on the on your program.
Thanks.
I agree with the lady who just talked. I hope you can forgive me speaking with a funny accent.
Accents are welcome here. Don't worry about it. You sound
fine.
Well,
but I'm going to make a comment about our commander-in-chief. I think he's a charlatan. What he presented yesterday with his words is a smokescreen. We have heard these kind of comments before. He just does not produce. One of your guests some time ago called, let's look at this guy's scorecard. It's zero. Honduras. Haiti now, their performance with their military, it's appalling. And just two more things. He talked about these small colleges. I come from a country in Europe where we have apprenticeships. that is 10 times better than these colleges where they shove people in it, they have no experience, and they put them through college and they come out, they have no clue what's going on. Put the people through a simple apprenticeship program. Once they know what they want, then they send them to college. Then they learn something.
Thank you.
And the next thing, I'm a small businessman, and Obama talked a lot about small business people. He has no clue what's going on. My bank, Bank of America, holds my credit card hostage. They won't even release it for some technical reason.
But he said that he was going to want to give money to community banks to extend credit to small businesses like yours. Would that be a good thing for you?
No, it will not work. These people don't even talk to you. They have no authority. I tried to work with my bank at the local level. They can do nothing for you. They can do absolute nothing for you. Been decided somewhere in a corporate office, and they have no clue what I go through to find financing for a water-saving device, and I'm still struggling with it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your comments, Frank. Let's go next to Jim in Los Angeles. Jim, welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Thank you, Sonali, and thank you for what you do. And hello to your guest, Kathy Kelly and Dominic. Wanted to send our condolences to the family of Howard Zinn, number one. Number two, I think a good president teaches us that we have to constantly stay engaged in the system. And I think the thing that we have forgotten at the base is that we, the voters, the individuals who helped put him there, we are still here. And the power that put him there is, although sleeping, needs to be once again reinvigorated and put back into motion. In many cases, it already is still in motion, but we need to remember that the finger we're pointing at him actually also points back at us to keep us challenged and engaged. So thank you so much for what you do, Sonali.
Thanks so much, Jim. And we'll get our guest responses in just a couple of moments. Taking one more call, Jesus from Van Nuys. Welcome to Uprising. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I kind of fancy myself as an amateur historian, and I almost gave up on history a couple of years ago until I heard Howard Zinn, and he started talking about the fallacies of war, the imperialism of the United States, and it really inspired me to keep going, to pursue history. And every time I talk to people who don't know anything about history, and I mentioned a few things here and there, things that I pick up, their eyes just light up as if it's something new and they didn't know. And he taught me that. You know, people don't know history, but it changes people. It does. Made me think different of the ideas of war, especially just war, the idea of a just war, and how, in the end, the civilians and the poor always suffer. Nobody wins. It's just death.
Well, Jesus, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for calling in and expressing your thoughts. We all are going to be missing Howard Zinn tremendously. Kathy Kelly and Dominic Apollon, your last thoughts, starting with you, Kathy.
Well, in an obituary that was written last night about Howard Zinn, they quoted him as saying that the American people have a responsibility to help push Barack Obama beyond being a mediocre president. And he also said a mediocre president is a dangerous president. And so I think as we look for our security, we can find our security in the education that your callers have said they want to advance. Education about our role in the world that's a different role, where we're not considering ourselves the indispensable or the exceptional nation with a menacing military might, but rather a nation committed to the kinds of change that would radically reform our lifestyles, our approach to consumption, and our willingness to extend a hand of peace to other countries.
Thank you so much, Kathy Kelly. Finally, Dominic Apollon, your last thoughts on the State of the Union and any reflections you might have on Howard Zinn.
Yeah, you know, I was really floored. I didn't hear about Howard Zinn's death until yesterday evening. I was actually on another radio program on Cisco Radio. My organization's blog is called racewire.org, and they, you know, we put up a quote from Zinn yesterday, and it reads, quote, "I suggest that if you know history, then you might not be so easily fooled by the government when it tells you you must go to war for this or that reason, that history is a protective armor against being misled." And, you know, as your listeners heard, or were saying, we should protect ourselves from being misled from President Obama yesterday, and he talked about the bank bailouts and how, I hated it, we all hated it, but I think he lost a lot of credibility for not putting more reins and controls on the banks earlier, and now I think he's suffering, unfortunately, from that.
Well, Dominic, I want to thank you also so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dominic Apollon is Research Director at the Applied Research Center, a frequent commentator on race and politics in the news. Website is racewire.org. And Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. And their website is vcn.org. And we'll link to those websites from our site later today as well. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Howard Zinn once said, small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world. That's Howard Zinn. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening and stay tuned for an hour-long tribute to Howard Zinn. See you tomorrow at 8. Ooh, oh.